Welcome to Chicano Highlights. I am your host, the Beto Man. And Beto, for those of you who don't know, and we have a very special guest here today. We have Mr. Manuel Acuña. How are you doing, compañero?
Oh, fine, fine.
Good. Let's start off with your background. ¿De dónde son tus padres?
My dad was born in Salome, Arizona. My mom is from Santa Barbara, California.
¿Y cómo se llaman?
Manuel y la Eva.
All right. And how did they get together? How did they meet?
They were actually cowboys. My parents both were cowboys. They worked for a rancher in Arizona by Florence. And the families were longtime friends. So they knew each other for years before they started going out with each other. So they were real cowboys. They'd do the roundups, spend weeks out in the desert rounding up cattle.
¿Y cuándo se casaron?
They got married in 1946.
Wow.
I can't remember the month right now.
That's okay. Now, tell me, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have three brothers and two sisters.
¿Cómo se llaman?
I'm the oldest. Then the next one is Richard, and then Danny. Steve is the youngest boy, and then my sisters are Barbara and Sally.
All right. And now how did you end up in Arizona?
Okay, I was born in Tulare, California, but my family's roots were in Arizona. So we would... they were pretty much migrants. So, but when they did settle down, they settled down around where I live now, Coolidge.
All right. Now, you say that they were migrants. Let me ask you a question. Were they from Mexico, both of them?
No.
No. So they were Mexican-Americans born in the United States, both of them?
Yes.
Okay. So you're what we would consider second generation, ¿verdad?
Yes.
All right. And so then you grew up where?
In this little town called Coolidge.
All right. And where is Coolidge? Más o menos.
It's like 60 miles south of Phoenix.
All right. All right. And then where did you go to elementary school, middle school, and high school?
Okay. Coolidge was mostly where I went to school. I was promoted out of the eighth grade. I have no high school.
Okay. What school did you go to, though?
I went to Coolidge Unified. And then the last 2 years, I went to this little school that was been there since my parents went to school. I went seventh and eighth grade at this place called Kenilworth.
Okay. And what year, más o menos, did you promote from eighth grade?
Yo, man, I really can't tell you.
That's okay.
Because to me, man, time has never really been an issue. You know what I mean? I don't keep track of years, dates.
Simon, yeah, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
You graduated. ¿Y qué hiciste? Were you also working in the migrant fields?
Yeah, I started working full time when I turned 16, which was the legal age where you were not obligated to go to school.
Uh huh.
I had a hard time in school. I didn't like school. It was installed in this thing about not liking school from a very early age from the teachers that we had back in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s.
Okay, well, tell me why. ¿Qué pasó?
Well, example, when I was in the second grade having a school play, they had an opening for one more person, so I raised my hand. So the teacher looked at me, and she goes, "Number one, what makes you think that you can sing?" That stunned me. And then she goes, "Secondly, it calls for a costume. Can your parents even afford to buy you this costume or for your mother to make it?" This is a class of about 25 people, and she singled me out. And that was just one of many bad experiences that I had in school. So at a very, from the second grade, I started feeling, you know, I started getting negative about school. I hated school. I didn't even try to learn. Okay. I started school in the kindergarten. Spanish, for a lack of better, you know, Spanish was our first language in school. I did not know. I started school at 6. I didn't know how to speak English. Because nobody in my family spoke it. They all knew how to speak English, but Spanish was what we used. Even after we learned how to talk English, we could not use it, especially around my grandfather. He would just cut into us if we were speaking English around him, let alone try to speak English to him. You know?
Yeah.
So that's how things started. And then throughout my 8 years in school, I kept running into these very racial, because these teachers were already in their late 60s, early 70s. So they came from a time where they could pretty much do and say whatever they want to any, minority.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what set the tone for me wanting to learn. I don't even have a GED.
Mm-hmm.
I lied when I went to work before they started really doing checks on you. Mm-hmm. I lied about my education. You know, the applications, highest grade, I'd put 8th grade. Then, you know, high school GED, I would lie. I would say I had a GED. So, you know, when I got to the 8th grade, I was already 16. So when I graduated or was promoted from the 8th grade, my dad said to me, you know, he sat me down and says, "You're not going to high school."
Mm-hmm.
I've got a 3rd grade education, and it hasn't hindered me in any way. Mm-hmm. Even though he was on the cotton fields, you know, that was my first job, picking cotton.
All right, tell me a little bit about cotton, porque yo no sé nada. Is it hard work?
Yes. When I first started, that was before the cotton picker, a machine. So you went out and you picked the cotton right off the plant. And you would tie on a sack around your waist, and you just start putting cotton in there till it got to at least 100 pounds. Okay, I'm a very small frame person. So, you know, a person like me picking up 100 pounds, you'd throw it on your shoulder, you'd go out to the end of the rows where there was a scale, you would hang that sack on that scale, and then you had to climb a homemade ladder 15, 20 feet with this 100 pounds on your shoulder, get up on the board they had up there, and then you had to shake the cotton loose to dump it into that trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when the cotton picker came into existence, they hadn't been perfected, so they would leave a lot of cotton on the ground. So then that opened a second job for us. After the cotton pickers went through, we would pick up the cotton off the ground. And usually, when you went out, because you're talking about walking a quarter mile, dragging a sack or carrying it on your shoulder, so you would try to put as much cotton in that sack to get you as close as you could to the end of the row where the scale was.
Mm-hmm.
Which my usual weight was between 80 to 120 pounds of cotton that I would weigh.
Wow.
The price of cotton was 3 cents a pound. So usually you try to at least go out there with 100 pounds of cotton.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're talking about the 1950s, ¿verdad?
This was already into the 60s.
Oh, already into the 60s.
But my career started out, even before I started school, my dad would be on the cotton fields, and then my mom would go and take all of us, and we would help pick cotton and put it in either a basket or on the ground. And so when my dad got to where we were at, there was already 10, 15 pounds of cotton waiting for him, so he would just put it in his sack and keep on going.
Okay. And so then you worked as a family unit, ¿verdad?
Yes, yes.
How old? I mean, did you start at 16 or was this even younger?
No, this was, I was probably, as far as I can remember back, I started going out into the cotton fields when I was probably like about 9, wow. Maybe even younger, mm-hmm. which was the norm for everybody, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People didn't understand why the Mexican families were so large. But, you know, 10, 12 kids. But what they were looking at, this is the way I figured it. The more kids, the more income.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And education to people like my dad, who had a third grade education, wasn't a very big thing. You know?
Right. Now, did you grow up in poverty? Would you say it was poverty or did you know it was poverty?
I guess I finally realized that that it was poverty when I hit about maybe like 12 years old. It was all about the cotton. This was wintertime. If we had a rainy year, there was no work. At that time, food stamps were non-existent, workmen's anything. They didn't provide you with anything. The government had a program. It was called commodities, which consisted of a 5-pound bag of powdered milk, 5-pound bag of cornmeal, and what was considered beef in a can and pork in a can. And there was no beans, nothing that could really be used as to what our diets consisted of. So if you drank a glass of that powdered milk, you were going to be pretty regular for a while. You know, it was just like drinking a laxative, you know.
Right, right. Now tell me about the city itself and that area. Now, was it controlled by the Anglo establishment, or the percentage, was it Chicano, Black, Anglo? How was it broken down?
Well, the population, Coolidge was a very, very prosperous town because it was a farming community. Okay, during the cotton season, starting in summer, mostly it was just the local folks. You'd get out there and you'd thin cotton because at that time the price of seed was so low that these farmers were just, they would just waste a lot of seed. So our job was to come in with a hoe and thin out the cotton, leaving about 6 inches between each plant. So when the actual picking started, then you had people coming in from Texas, New Mexico, Mexican Americans, and the population would probably like triple there in the little town of Coolidge. And at that time, there was department stores, grocery stores. You know, it was a little booming town that was controlled by agriculture. The farmers dictated as to what happened in that town. So it was mostly, Anglo control.
Now, was there a theater?
We had two theaters.
Mm-hmm.
We had like 3 or 4 drug stores, grocery stores. The name brand at that time was Bash's.
And the theaters, how did they handle the difference between Anglos and Chicanos?
Okay, we had two theaters. One was called San Carlos, and the other one was called The Studio. San Carlos You could go to either one, right? But they preferred you to go to San Carlos. And the biggest part of the people in there were Mexican Americans. At the studio, which was pretty much control as to how you looked, how you acted, if you were a minority, that's how you were allowed to go into that theater. So it wasn't segregated, supposedly, but it was control.
Now, how much did it cost at that time, and could you afford to go to the movies?
For a quarter, which was what we were given to go into the theater, it covered your admission, box of popcorn, a soda, and a candy bar with that quarter.
So money was totally different, ¿verdad? The value of money was just totally different than what it is now.
Yeah, and the price of food. You know, when you could go buy a loaf of bread for 12 cents, gas, when I remember, you know, where I actually started paying attention to the prices of things, gas, for a dollar, you could get 3 gallons of gas.
Right. Now, you were pretty rebellious, running around on the streets and learning, getting your stripes, ¿verdad? Did you ever get involved into any gangs, go to prison, anything like that?
No, at that time, especially in a community like Coolidge, gangs were non-existent. And they're still the same way, you know. There really isn't any gangs. There's a lot of crime in Coolidge, a lot of drug dealing.
And that has more to do with poverty.
Yes, because there is no work. Unless, if you're a Mexican-American, whoever, if you didn't go to high school and hang around with the right Anglos, or even if they were Mexican and their last name wasn't well known in Coolidge, you weren't going to get a job in Coolidge other than farm work.
Wow.
So it's still pretty much the same. We have no theaters. They finally built a Walmart, which was, that's where 3/4 of the people from the surrounding area work, at a Walmart.
Right. And now presently you also have a lot of prisons around the area, right?
Yeah, it's Florence was the original. That's where they built the first state prison. And what is so crazy about the whole thing, they approached Florence, okay, what do you want? Do you want a university or do you want a prison in your area? They went with a prison.
Wow.
Now there is, of course, there's a county jail because Florence is the county seat. Then you have like 5 state prisons from minimum to maximum. And then these private security firms started coming in, and now there's about 3 prisons that are run by private security.
All right. Now, let's jump into, you reached 18, 19 years old. Now we're talking about the Vietnam era. You're a Vietnam veteran, ¿verdad?
Yes.
Tell me what was your rank? What unit did you serve with?
Okay. To start things off, I turned 19 in October of 66. By December of 66, I was GI issue. I got drafted.
Did you ever think of not going?
Oh, I had options. Okay, at that time, I was going out with this girl. Her mom knew a lot about herbs. She supposedly was a bruja. she dealt, you know, palm reading and stuff like that. Okay, she told me she could fix me up where she would give me something that would raise my blood pressure where, you know, I couldn't go into the military. The thing was that when I got drafted, I was 19 and I weighed 110 pounds. there was no way that I was going to convince those doctors at the induction station that I had high blood pressure, weighing 110 pounds, okay? Second option, my dad's sister lived in Caborca, Sonora. She told my dad and talked to both of us, let me take Manuel. There is no record. There is no way they can track us down in Mexico, so he can just disappear in Mexico. Okay, I thought that was a pretty good option. I didn't know too much. We used to go to Caborca off and on when I was younger. But my dad told me, you've been served with your draft notice. You are going to go to the military. His brother-in-laws and one of my uncles had all served in World War II. He goes, we don't like it, you don't like it, but you're obligated. You know, so you are an American citizen. So that's what started my military career. Of course, in the military, I can't exactly say how we used to hit example, right way, wrong way, the Army way.
Right.
So we showed up at Fort Bliss on New Year's Eve of 66. There was a big mix up. These sergeants were showing up from parties, drunk, still in their Class A uniforms, and very upset. The one guy that was there to meet us there at the induction station there in Fort Bliss was so drunk he couldn't even talk. They weren't expecting us, but he had duty. So step one, that's where we learned about the military, how things work in the military.
Were you shocked inside the military? Was there a lot of racism inside the military?
Big time. Most of the NCOs were from places like Alabama, Tennessee, those southern states. They were career soldiers. I had sergeants that didn't learn how to read or write until they joined the military. Some of them still had trouble filling out reports and stuff, and those were the people that were in charge of us.
Wow. So they got preferential treatment.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And they put all the Chicanos as cannon fodder in the front.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Vietnam, most of the infantry units, I was a combat engineer. Most of the infantry units were like 3/4 Mexican, and the rest were black or considered, they were Anglo, but coming from the South. They were in the same boat we were at, poor, uneducated. So the only, let me go back a little bit. When at the induction station, they do physicals. They start from one end to the other. I got on the scale, and they had height requirements, and they had weight requirements. If you were overweight, they were going to get you down to the proper weight. When I stepped on the scale, the guy had to move it around because he couldn't believe, you know, the numbers showing up on the scale. So he yells out, 110 pounds, how should we, document this? And then the guy doing the paper, he goes, medium weight. So I was medium weight. Basic training consisted of 8 weeks. In those 8 weeks, they put on 40 pounds onto my frame. Every meal, I had to drink 3 glasses of either milk or chocolate milk. The people that were overweight got half rations, and people like me that were underweight, we got that half a ration, and they will single us out. the NCO, the DI would stand behind us, and we had to clean our plates, and we had to drink 3 glasses of milk a meal.
Wow.
So at the end of the 8 weeks, I was lean, mean, and I weighed 150 pounds.
All right. So is to tell me a little bit, well, your rank and position.
Okay, like I said, basic training was 8 weeks, AIT, where you had your MOS, which was what you did in the service, was another 8 weeks. A 15-day delay en route, they'd send you home for 15 days. I showed up in Los Angeles, San Francisco. I was shipped to Vietnam, 90th replacement. You wait there a week, week and a half, till they find somewhere to place you. So I was in South Vietnam, and of course, still running into the same type of racism, that because it's the same people only in a different place. So it was an experience. It was a good experience, bad experience. I wouldn't do it again, but it did teach me a lot about myself.
Right. And so then, did you eat, did you get any care packages, those stuff from home, like beans?
Not so much beans, but I did get a lot of the stuff that I was used to eating. My grandfather was big with jerky. So there's this place in Coolidge, it's called Bottle Stop. So my parents would go over there and they'd stock up on like beer nuts, jerky, and stuff like that. So the guy finally asked my parents, so do you guys have a store going somewhere buying this stuff that you buy? And she says, no, our son's in Vietnam. This is a care box. So he started donating different little items. But mostly what my care boxes consisted of was a lot of jerky, beer nuts, Vienna sausage, stuff that wouldn't spoil and it could be shipped. And there was other items I can't remember exactly all, but those were about the 3 that I look forward to.
And what about Chile?
they would send me those So Hot mix, vinegar, chilies and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that wouldn't spoil.
Right.
They tried sending me tortillas one time, but it took so long to get there that it was just a green looking something or other. From the mold.
All right. And tell me about the Vietnamese. I mean, the people in general. How did you know the difference between the good guys and the bad guys?
Well, the how you told them apart was some were shooting at you and some weren't. So you figured the people shooting at you was the enemy, because it was the same people, only in just different sections of Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Regardless of what the people, okay, we call them Vietnamese, they call themselves Vietnam. They didn't want us there. They, a GI was a dollar sign. They try to sell you everything from silks, sodas. Women try to sell yourself to them, to you. And then, of course, there was the marijuana. Every village had a marijuana field. It came to us in packages already packed, 50 cents for an ounce, $2 to $3 for a shoebox. First thing they told you when you got there, they explained to you about how easy it was to get marijuana and what the penalties was for getting caught with marijuana. I had no idea what marijuana was. My idea of whatever coming up after we got to, to the teeny years was getting a local bootlegger to buy us a 6-pack of beer, which was $1.25, and there were usually 6-7 guys in the car to split a 6-pack. That was my only experience as far as, getting a buzz was drinking a half a can of beer. you get to Vietnam, it was so available, and there were so many GIs smoking it. After about 2 months, then they finally decided you weren't CID, which was the civilian, yada, 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 you weren't a cop. Then usually they took you into the, you know, the drug culture.
And showed you the ropes.
Showed me the ropes. The first guy that got me high was on January 8th of 67. Uh-huh. His name was Bone Cutter. Uh-huh. And he was proud at the fact that I was Cherry. And that's exactly why I remember the date. I can even tell you the time, Vietnam time, because he made a big thing out of, July. I'm sorry, it was in July. Uh-huh. July, 8 o'clock, I'm getting you high.
That's interesting. Now, we are not promoting marijuana. We're not promoting drugs. For those listeners who are out there, we are interviewing Mr. Manuel Acuña, an individual who grew up in Coolidge, Arizona, and we're talking about his life experiences. So right now we are in Vietnam, ¿verdad? Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to talk about Vietnam? Because I know that a lot of veterans don't want to get into a lot of stories about Vietnam. Is there anything else that you want to share?
Yeah, it was we landed in Benoit. Commercial, I was on a Continental jet, stewardesses, the whole thing. The only thing they can do was serve liquor to us. But Benoit had not been they hadn't had any kind of enemy activity for 4 years. I was in Vietnam for 20 minutes and we got our first motor attack. Here we are, 200 and some plus, we were straight out of AIT. So what helped us was that there was a E5 who had been in the States on emergency leave. He took four of us and he led us through how not to die. Getting under cover. That was my first experience of Vietnam. 20 minutes into the country, and I'm already running to hide because they're trying to kill me.
Wow. And how were Chicanos with Chicanos, blacks with blacks, white with whites, and all that intermingling?
When somebody has your back, you're not looking at the color of their skin. Most of the racial, if there was, it didn't come from the GI. It usually came from the non-coms, you know, the sergeants and stuff like that. For the fact that, I don't know how they chose engineers, but they were mostly all from the South. People with last names like Stonewall Jackson, that kind of stuff, you know. So there was a lot of racial from the NCOs, but amongst us who were actually out in the field, the only thing that concerned you about the man next to you was how he reacted when it hit the fan. Mm-hmm. That was the only, you weren't, there was like the blacks were from the South too, so they had been, you know, they had, Arizona wasn't so much racial, you know, and then I grew up in a black community, so I didn't know about racism. Blacks were my friends. I grew up amongst them. Chicanos, well, of course, you know, this, you know, you're going to go with who you are, you know. So in Vietnam, it wasn't, there was, but like I said, it was mostly from the, you know, E5s and above, you know, mm-hmm. all the non-coms. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, what other jobs did you hold? Well, first of all, when did you come back from Vietnam?
I came back from Vietnam in May of 68. I had 4 months left, tour of duty, which I served in Fort Leonard, Missouri, where I took my AIT. Mm-hmm. People that were coming back from Vietnam, usually we were all draftees. we had between 3 and 4 months left in the military. They didn't know what to do with us because they could not assign us a long-term job. So they would just find details for us to do. And we didn't exactly go by, we didn't care about rank. We didn't care about the procedure, the military's procedure. You know, what are you going to do, send me to Vietnam? That was our response to just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaking off to EM clubs while you're still on duty.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that, you know. And they couldn't stop you, and they didn't know what to do with us.
Right.
I had it, my details consisted of everything from funeral details throughout Missouri. I was there for a while. I was security for battalion, escorting prisoners to the stockade, which I actually escorted two of my the guy that slept above me on my bunk bed and the guy next door for AWOL. So I actually got to escort him to the stockade.
Wow.
That's, you know, it's, and there is no such thing. They gave me a loaded 45. If he runs, if he gets away from you, whatever time he was going to serve, you picked up his time.
Mm-hmm.
And you are authorized to shoot.
Wow.
To kill. This is in the States. So I had a couple of details when I went to Kentucky to pick up people that had been arrested by civilian cops. They'd find out they were military, AWOL. So I went twice. First class, everything. Everything, you know, you had everything you wanted, and it was coming out of that guy's payroll.
Wow. Wow. So were you happy to come back? I mean, were you...
Sure. I mean, you got people trying to kill you, and you come back to the States. The thing about this was that it was during the 68 Democrat convention in Chicago. There was a lot of rioting, so we started training for riot control. So a lot of red, you know, we'd load up on the trucks, then they unload us, and you know, we were on code red all the time. And then one day they called us all, we jumped on the trucks, and then they didn't unload us. And we were like probably, you know, Missouri and like from St. Louis to Chicago was probably about a day's travel in a truck. We were deployed in Chicago, and we were supposed to be observers and just backup. As soon as we got there, we were put right into the mix of things, you know. No shields, M14 with a bayonet.
Wow.
V formation, you don't break formation. Anybody gets near you, stick them.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are, just came back from Vietnam. Here we are in our own country. And again, we're fighting for our lives. Bricks, urine, feces, people throwing bricks from 4 or 5 stories above you. You know? So it was kind of a shock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you get to Vietnam, when you go from the airport, they would load you, we called them watermelons, these little green buses, screens on the window, and an arm shotgun, okay, the driver. And okay, when we got back to the States, I came to Edwards Air Force Base in Oakland. So we went through customs. Then we were loaded almost in the exact same bus with a wire screen on the windows. The only difference was that we didn't have an arm shotgun riding with that bus, but we have a driver. We were snuck into San Francisco, into a gym. There was probably like about, I don't know, 800, 900 of us. We were given our Class A khakis, and then we were released in like 10, 15 guys at a time, and they wouldn't even let us go out the same door.
Wow.
This is in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would just, you would just kind of blend into, you try to get to the airport to come back to Arizona. They would give you a $25, your flight was paid for. It was furnished, you had these vouchers, and then they gave you a voucher for $25 for your eats.
Yeah.
So.
So you picked up PTSD, right?
Yes.
Now, when did you realize that you had PTSD?
I guess maybe about 07. I started taking counseling, seeing psychiatrists and psychologists, and they finally...
So you never realized that you had it for 40 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, it influenced my life in a lot of ways, and I had no idea why. I can't blame it all on Vietnam, but I'd say about three quarters of it was influenced by Vietnam, having served in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And how are you dealing with it today?
Counseling, a lot of counseling. Just, and then as you grow older, pictures fade. You start settling in. I'm 69 years old. So, you know, from the time I was 19 to now, it's been quite a few years.
Yeah.
You know, you do the math.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now, so you're back in the States. Now, tell me about relationships, women.
You know, when I got back to Vietnam, I mean, to the United States, the town of Florence, which is like 9 miles from Coolidge, they would have a Cinco de Mayo celebration, the church. Okay, I was still in my class A's with my little ribbons and, you know, I was looking sharper than, you know. I was a chick magnet. So I was in my cousin's car, and then my mom and my dad, they were standing right by the road, and they seen Lupe's car go by. I might tear up a little bit, okay?
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's the, you know, again, it takes a lot of effort to talk about those things because memories flash in our heads, you know, and we react, you know, we have passion, we have emotion, and that's only natural. There's nothing wrong with it, verdad? And, you know, a lot of times we hear, los hombres no lloran, verdad?
Yeah.
But sometimes, hey, you know, as a man, we have to understand that as we get older, también, we become more sentimental. And we start realizing that you know, yes, we have to be tough. It has to be tough love. But at some point, we also have to return love, ¿verdad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I got off the car in the parking lot and I started walking towards, I had seen my parents right alongside the road. And I didn't even know my mom could run that fast.
Yeah.
So after the initial with my parents, then all these girls, some I knew and some I didn't even know who they were, started coming up to me, hugging me, big old kiss. Welcome back, Manuel.
Yeah.
I said, all right. So that's how I met my first wife. At that time, I wasn't really ready for commitment. You know, I don't want to speak ill of her, but, you know, I was a pretty persuasive guy.
Right.
So I was 21 years old. By then, I turned 21 in the military.
Right.
She got pregnant. Okay. My first deal was to run.
You first know, reaction, verdad?
Yes.
And it comes from fear. It comes from not knowing what's coming. It comes from our immaturity to deal with the responsibility. It comes from not understanding and wanting to be free, you know, wanting to be with many different girls, you know, experiment, verdad?
Yeah.
Pero the problem is that once you have children in the picture, it becomes a lot harder.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And like my first, I had a cousin that lived by Los Angeles. I called her up. Her name is Ruth. I say, hey, Ruth, do you think you could house me for a little while I get going. She goes, sure, come down. So, you know, that was my out. I had a place to go. She says, I'll send you a bus ticket. Back then, you didn't think about flying anywhere, you know. So she says, I'll send you a bus ticket. So, okay. So I'm getting my stuff ready. Okay, I've already been the military, been to Vietnam. I'm 21 years old, and I'm packing a bag. And then my dad goes, what's up? Those weren't the exact words, but I said, I'm leaving. I'm going to go visit Kuka. And they already knew that my girlfriend was pregnant. He says, no, you're not. You've created a situation, and you're going to stay here and correct it. I said, no, I'm not. He says, yes. I said, hey, Dad, I'm 21 years old. His response was, I'm going to sweeten that up a little bit. He says, no, you're not. Those weren't the exact words, okay? We're on the radio. So he says, you're not going. I told him, you want to see a picture of my driver's license? He says, I'm 21. He says, I don't care. I'm your dad, and you are going to face your responsibility. So we were married, and before my first daughter was born, I had two other daughters, but my mind was always on going, you know, whether it was Vietnam, whether it was just me, I wanted to get out. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't very faithful to my wife. I supported her, you know, my kids, they never lack anything, but I always had my eye on other, you know, whatever fancies I had, or fantasies, know, I would go with it. And my wife just looked the other way, being a good, faithful Mexican wife, okay? Mm-hmm. Then I met Miss Crazy USA, and I abandoned my family. Mm-hmm. Man, I had it going on, partying all over Phoenix, the city, living a life that I thought was what I wanted. 4 years into that, she had her eye on somebody else. Mm-hmm. By that time, my family was already living in California. My ex had taken my girls, and out of sight, out of mind was my, you know, reaction to this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Drugs, alcohol, partying, that numbed everything. In Vietnam, like Beto says, we're not promoting drugs, but in Vietnam, marijuana was your escape. Mm-hmm. Things got bad. I'd say about 99% of us did not smoke when we were out in the field. But coming back to the base camp, first thing you did was you go out to the coke. There was different, they had these little shacks, okay? There was the coke girls, and then there was the boom boom girls.
What okay. does that mean?
Well, we can't say that on the radio, oh, okay. right? They were paid prostitutes.
Orale, orale, orale. Okay.
So then around any stop where there was, you know, a stop with GIs, these little kids would come up to you with a C-ration box. They had the silk on top. No. Then they had the little baby dolls for you to send to your girlfriend back home. No. Then the sunglasses, what they call mad dogs now. And then after everything was no, they would turn the silk and everything. They would flip it to the side, and here's all these bags of marijuana. Yes. 50 cents, you know. So that's how you, alcohol has never been a big thing for me. It was, the military furnished you tobacco and alcohol. Even when we were out in the field, a chopper would come in, two beers for you, cigarettes, you know. So it was promoted in the military, tobacco and alcohol. Mm-hmm. So I was never, even to this day, I'm not much of a alcohol drinker, but I did struggle with drugs. Whatever the fad was at the time, I always fell back on the marijuana. And over there, that was how you, it was very potent, so that's how you coped, you know.
With the stress.
Any other thing, missing your family, all that stuff. Smoke a bowl, that took care of any anxiety, anything, right?
So you were in Phoenix, running around with the girls and living it up, and... ¿Y luego?
It was just, I guess it was more or less in my mind that this is what I wanted. You know, we had a lot of nightclubs all over Scottsdale, which is a pretty high-end community. Phoenix, do the South Side where the Chicanada was, the Crazies, Bangers. And then you had like Midtown, which was a little mixture of both. At that time, disco was the thing, you know, and they had a lot of nightclubs all over the city. Even though the girl I was with, I was 11 years older than she was. Even though she was a looker, my eye was always, I had a roaming eye, you know. And pick up a matchbook with somebody's phone number, 2 days later I'm calling this number, you know.
Right.
Even though I had everything that I thought I wanted. I had a son with her at the end of 4 years between how I was acting and her. You know, she had that roving eye too. We split up, and here's another child that I abandoned. I had more contact with him because he was still here. Like I said, out of sight, out of mind, my daughters were in Indio. So I would send them money off and on, of course, child support. Instead of sending it to the state, where the 1st and the 15th were called Mother's Day, I would send them directly to them. You know, so my last child support payment, I'll be 91 when I pay my last child support payment.
Wow. Now, I know this is a crazy question, but would you have done things differently?
I think a lot of my background kind of stopped me from being who I'm supposed to be, right? Vietnam didn't help. We were a very tight family unit. My friends were my cousins. You know, we lived in ranches. My brothers were my friends. We lived out in a farm somewhere that was 15, 20 miles from town. The next farm over might be 2 or 3 miles from where we lived. So my whole loyalty and my whole, as I knew it, my friends, like I say, were my cousins and my brothers. So I never formed attachment. I didn't have any friends because we moved around. I left the school. I said bye to my friends and all that. I went to a school in Casa Grande for 1 day. So the time it took us to move back to Coolidge, and then I show up at school and everybody says, hey, I thought you were moving. We did. I'm back. In 2 days' time, I was back because my dad, he wouldn't take anything from the farmers, so, and he could get a job anywhere he wanted to. So we went straight back to Coolidge. 2 days later, I was back at the school that I had left. So it was kind of hard to make friends when you were moving around so much, you know. So I don't know, and there's I guess it's a lot has to do with your personality. That's the way I see it, you know.
Right. So what I think what you're trying to say is that it takes time to become the person that that you should have been, that you always were, but it just never blossomed, ¿verdad?
Yeah.
It's like a flower. It has to it sometimes it takes longer in some people to blossom, to really become versus some really cold winters where it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And then in Vietnam, you made very few friends. You know, they're your buddies right now. 2 minutes later, they're gone.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying coming back home.
Yeah.
They're dead. you know. Right. So it was kind of hard to form, and I already had this thing, I guess it would be like a phobia,
yeah,
about, you know, what I had gone through in school and stuff like that. And then when you see your buddy laying there, it was kind of hard to form an attachment.
Right.
So I guess it carried over. I can't blame the war for everything in my life, but it didn't help.
Right, right. Okay, so now, so then you were married how many times then? Just once?
No, I was married twice. My first wife and my present wife. The only time I was married legally, I lived with women for 3 or 4 years, and then I'd move on.
On and off. All right. And so then now with your last, well, I don't want to say your last wife.
Yeah.
You never know. Pero,
well, no, I'm going to tell you something.
No pun intended.
Yeah, but well, at 69, what you thought was cool and what you could do, you can't do anymore.
Right.
So, yes, my present wife, she's Native American and a very patient woman. I say that she saved my life. I was into drugs, alcohol, partying, stand in the middle of a bar and call everybody out after 2 half pints of gin. You know, I was Superman. I was bulletproof. So when I met her, she was coming out of that life too. So she helped me a lot in showing me patience, how to be patient, how not to be so quick to anger or, you know, criticizing and stuff like that. I learned a lot from her. I've been with her for about 35 years.
Wow. Wow. And you did it. So how many kids do you have total?
Seven.
All right. And you still are attending PTS classes, PTSD classes. You're still going to the Vietnam, hospital?
Yeah, it's a veterans hospital. Yeah. And so I go to a clinic in Casa Grande, and the main hospital is in Tucson.
Okay. What do you do now?
As little as possible. I've got some dogs. I do a lot of, not gardening, but I have a lot of plants in pots.
Uh-huh.
My house looks like a jungle. My wife says I created my own jungle.
Uh-huh.
Any tree that comes up doesn't die. It just turns into another tree, which turns into more trees.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have paths. All my yard is full of trees, and I have paths that I follow throughout the yard.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how one's life, you know, retrospective, or that looking back, where you end up, you know what I mean? And
yes.
And it's a hard journey, but, you know, the reason why we do these interviews, compañero, is because I want to show the youngsters out there that nothing is given. Nothing is free.
No.
You know, you struggle each and every single day. You got to fight for what you got. You got to cherish what you got when you got it, because once it's gone, it's gone. And then you regret things that you should have probably done better. Now, you probably thank your dad. You're probably very angry at your dad at the time for making you do things that you didn't want to do.
Yes.
But now you appreciate him.
Yes, and back in my generation, there was no disrespect for your parents like there is now, you know. They, regardless of how old you were, when your dad told you to do something, whenever your mom told you to do something, there was, like me, when I rebelled against my dad about, I'm 21, you can't tell me what to do, he set me straight. You have responsibilities. You've created this. Now you have to take care of it. I was with my first wife for about 9 years. And then I always had leaving on my mind from day one. A very nice woman. Very, you know, she took care of me. But that's not what I was looking for, you know.
You weren't ready for it.
I wasn't ready for it.
Right.
I was 21, but I was very immature.
Yeah.
Okay, at 19, and I'm not saying I was backward, but not having that much contact with outside other than the school, moving around as much as we did, my attachment was to my family. Anybody else, outside my family, cousins, uncles, my brothers and sisters, it really wasn't a big thing, you know, to form attachments. Going back to what you said a while ago about, you know, losing stuff that you can't get back. The number one thing that when you lose that you can't get back is youth. Once you've moved on, you can't ever go back to being a youngster, to being the life that you lived. That's gone. You cannot go back to that, to being a young person anymore. So my advice is cherish it. Don't do a bunch of crazy stuff because you're young. You're not bulletproof. So that's all I got to say on that.
All right. All right. And looking at your life now and looking at all of those things, you know, your mom is still alive, ¿verdad?
Yes.
How old is she now?
She's 87.
And I've met her. I know she's a storm.
Yes.
Do you appreciate her?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. She's rough, tough, but she's always given us good advice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not in the friendliest motherly.
Tough love.
She wouldn't sit you on her lap and explain to you, smack upside the head, wake up.
And sometimes that's what we need, ¿verdad?
Yes. Yeah. That's what's lacking. Not getting into a whole bunch of, but when the government took over telling us what we could, how we could treat our kids and how to treat our kids, that's where the beginning of the end started as far as family structures, you know. And then, of course, things are changing. The technology and all this really is, you know, you see a whole family sitting around a dining room table and everybody has a cell phone. Nobody's talking to each other. I've actually seen some of my nieces sitting at the same sofa texting each other. These are, you know, 14, 15-year-old girls sitting on the same sofa and not speaking to each other. They're texting to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lack of communication, a lack of respect.
Big time.
You know, it's a lack of looking each other in the eye and saying, hey, I love you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah.
I'm very backward when it comes to technology. I don't text. My wife finally got me a Facebook page, which I don't contribute to it. Once in a great while, I'll look at whatever one of my family members is doing. But that's it. That's my extent. The only reason I carry a phone, to call my mom or have my mom call me or call my wife, because at one time she was doing a lot of traveling. That's the only reason I own a phone.
Right. All right, compañero. Well, we want to thank you for coming in. You've been listening to Chicano Highlights. I am the Beto Man. We've been talking to Mr. Manuel Acuña, a compañero out from Coolidge, Arizona, telling us about his life struggles and what he's gone through. Is there any last messages you want to tell the youth?
I guess it's number one, be aware of your surroundings. Number two, respect your mom and dad and all your family.
All right.
Bottom line.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us, Raza. We want to thank you for tuning in, and we will see you hasta la próxima. Ahí te guacho.